The Guardian.
Don't tell me words don't matter. I have a dream, just words. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, just words. We have nothing to fear but fear itself, just words, just speeches.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight on the landing grounds, we shall fight in the fields and in the streets, we shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
To those waiting with bated breath for that favorite media catchphrase, the U-turn, I have only one thing to say. U-turn if you want to. The ladies, not for turning.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Dad, by striking, they're trying to effect a change in management so that they can be happier and more productive.
Lisa, if you don't like your job, you don't strike. You just go in every day and do it really half-assed. That's the American way.
So what is rhetoric? Rhetoric is, as simply defined as possible, the art of persuasion, the attempt by one human being to influence another in words. It's no more complicated than that. You're probably accustomed to thinking of rhetoric in terms of formal oratory, the sort of public speeches you see politicians make on television, CEOs make at AGMs, and priests make on Sunday mornings in church. That is, true, when it's at its most visible. That's when rhetoric puts on a dinner jacket and polishes its dancing shoes. But that is only one part of a huge area that the term covers. Rhetoric is a field of knowledge. That is, something susceptible to analysis and understanding, in the same way poetry is. Just as people studying poetry talk about anapests and caesuras and catalectic feet, people studying rhetoric have learnt to recognise and name some of the ways in which rhetorical language behaves. But rhetoric is also, and primarily, a practical skill, what one of its earliest and most important theorists, Aristotle, describes as a techne. That's the root of the words technical and technique. And in calling it that, he intended to contrast it with philosophy. Philosophy constitutes a set of methods for arriving at a disinterested understanding of the eternal truths of the world. Rhetoric is directed as a practical goal. It's a means to an end. Rhetoric is hustling, and our forefathers knew it. For 15 centuries or so, the study of rhetoric was at the centre of Western education. To be able to recognise rhetorical techniques and have them at your command was a central accomplishment of any educated man. They were men then, mostly. Sorry.
Sam Leith there, reading an excerpt from his book, You Talking to Me, Rhetoric from Aristotle to Obama. We'll be hearing more from Sam later.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Now, it's commonly thought by those people who think about such things that rhetoric was handed down to us in 367 BC when Aristotle sat down to write three volumes on the subject. And the ancient Greeks' poetry wasn't bad either. In this week's podcast, we're also looking at the new interest in a poem that's more than 2,500 years old. There's been a raft of new versions of Homer's Iliad out in recent weeks, including an Iliad-related poem, Memorial, by Alice Oswald. Alice's 80-page poem strips away Homer's verse to give us a terse, spare monument to the heroes that are slaughtered in the Iliad. She was interviewed recently at the Poetry Trust's annual Poetry Prom in Aldborough. Festival director Naomi Jaffa began by asking if Alice worked directly from the Greek or from one of the English translations.
I was quite careful. I really wanted to work directly from the Greek because one of the motivations for doing it was the feeling that English translations have always slanted the reading of Homer towards something rather kind of grand and noble and lofty. And what I get from the Greek is a feeling of incredible energy and freshness. It was actually lovely to abandon the translations completely and just fill myself with the Iliad.
So tell us something about your relationship with the Iliad.
I first started reading it when I must have been about 16, and I was lucky enough to be the only person at school studying Greek, and I had a very sympathetic classics teacher who just allowed me to forget about the rest of the syllabus and just read Homer, because I became determined that I wanted to read the whole of the Odyssey. I think we had one book set for A-level.
Yes.
It was just such a treat. It was really exciting because I felt that it wasn't like literature. It was something quite different. It was much more like life. It was much less mediated, really. And I could never quite define what the difference lay in. And I think most of my writing has been an attempt to try and establish what that different flavour is, what that kind of freshness is.
And you wanted to do a version of your own because you see yourself as part of the tradition, a sort of continuum of English poets who respond.
All my poems, Dart particularly, have been attempts to make versions of Homer. And I've always sort of avoided the idea that I might translate or do a version of Homer. And then it just struck me kind of a few years ago that actually what I was really trying to do could maybe be expressed better if I actually turned to the Greek and did a so-called translation.
So could you talk a bit about your approach and the choices you made of what to focus on and what to cut and basically how you've reduced sort of 600 pages to about 80?
Yes, I've done something a little bit bold, which is to get rid of the main narrative about Achilles. And I love that narrative, but whenever I see it represented in English, it fills me with this sort of public school, white-limbed, masculine kind of lofty world that I find nauseating. And I have always been very moved by the little biographies of soldiers that crop up throughout the Iliad, the ordinary people who trip over or die crying for their mother or whatever it might be. And that is partly, I suppose, a kind of political stance.
I wondered if you feel that the Iliad has a particular relevance for us now, or at least what you've done with Memorial, because you seem to be saying that all deaths matter, that almost it feels like a sort of modern war poem.
I hope it will have modern relevance. I'd feel it was pointless if it didn't. Certainly for me, it's incredibly important that each individual death is counted rather than someone's death was more important than someone else's. Mm. And I was quite inspired also by David Jones's In Parenthesis, where at the beginning he has just a little something at the beginning of the poem that says, "In memory of all common and hidden men."
Yes.
And I've always loved that yes. It's not about heroism, it's yes. just about yes. ordinary people.
I mean, I love the way that each of the deaths, I thought, oh, you know, there's just lots of guys dying with lots of spears through, you know, exposed bits of their body, but actually every death is individual and different because some die embracing it, some die taken by surprise, some die terrified. Yeah. In each one you manage to sort of make it an individual rather than a collective.
Yes, to me they read as very real, those people. I really think they were real. And they're incredibly accurately, topographically placed in Homer. You feel like he's almost got a map of the whole of ancient Greece and he knows where each man comes from and who their parents were. Mm. And that's amazing to me, partly because I'm interested anyway in that songline idea that poems can be kind of maps of places.
Mm. Of course, this is pre-writing. It was an oral record, and that's another reason for thinking that these people existed, because they, you know, their memory of them was being handed down.
I studied classics for sort of 4 years and never went to Greece until 2 years ago. And when I finally went there and saw these incredible big monumental stones that were commemorating people's deaths with nothing on them, they're just blank stones, and you can really see, of course, a poem is necessary to remember the stories of these people.
The first to die was Protesilaus, a focused man who hurried to darkness with 40 black ships, leaving the land behind. Men sailed with him from those flower-lit cliffs where the grass gives growth to everything, Pyrrhus, Iton, Teleus, Antron. He died in midair, jumping to be first ashore. There was his house, half built. His wife rushed out, clawing her face. Podarcus, his altogether less impressive brother, took over command. But that was long ago. He's been in the black earth now for thousands of years. Like a wind murmur begins a rumour of waves, one long note getting louder. Like a land ripple, when the west wind runs through a field wishing and searching, nothing to be found, the corn stalks shake their green heads. Like a wind murmur begins a rumour of waves, one long note getting louder, the water breathes a deep sigh. Like a land ripple, when the west wind runs through a field, wishing and searching, nothing to be found, the cornstalks shake their green heads. Echepolis, a perfect fighter, always ahead of his men, known for his cold, seed-like concentration, moving out and out among the spears, died at the hands of Antilochus. You can see the hole in the helmet just under the ridge where the point of the spear pressed through and stuck in his forehead, letting the darkness leak down over his eyes. Elephenor from Euboea, in command of 40 ships, son of Chalcodon, nothing is known of his mother, died dragging the corpse of Echepolis, a little flash of flesh showing under the shield as he bent. He wore his hair long at the back. Like leaves, sometimes they light their green flames and are fed by the earth, and sometimes it snuffs them out.
Our thanks to the Poetry Trust for this edited extract of Alice Oswald's interview and launch reading from Memorial, which took place at its annual Poetry Prom in August. Check out www.thepoetrytrust.org for more poetry podcasts. Now, as we've said, Memorial's just one of a rush of brand new treatments of the oldest poem in Western literature, Homer's Iliad. There's also Madeline Miller's debut novel, The Song of Achilles, which imagines the childhoods of Homer's heroes Achilles and Patroclus. And there's a brand new translation by Stephen Mitchell, which promises to recreate the ancient epic as a contemporary poem. So why are today's authors so obsessed with Homer? We assigned Charlotte Higgins to find out, and she enlisted the expert advice of author, historian and classicist Tom Holland and Oxford classics professor Tim Whitmarsh. Take it away, Charlotte.
Tom, what do you think it is about Homer that makes authors keep coming back and back to him and keep reworking the poems in, as translations or as novels or as other poems?
There's a very famous short story by Borges where God meets Shakespeare and says to Shakespeare, "You are the human who has been most like me. You are the one who has been most creative." And I think that people have the same attitude towards Homer. Pope famously compared him to sort of a fertile field, a seedbed. Plato described him as being godlike. And I think it's that sense we have that this is where everything begins. You look back to Homer and you are conscious that you are part of a fabulously ancient tradition and a tradition that continues to give.
Tim, do you think there's anything actually about the poems themselves? I mean, poetic qualities to the poems themselves that make people want to engage with them as writers?
Yes, I do, actually, yes. I mean, it's certainly the case that there's something in the air at the moment that is motivating all these Iliadic translations, focusing on the Iliad in particular. These are poems of cultural conflict, these are poems of war, and of course we're reaching for these particular poems at a particular time in Western history. But the poems themselves are extraordinarily rich and extraordinarily capable of being reinvented for different generations. The Iliad in particular is fascinating because it should be a poem about the Greeks trashing the Trojans. Homer doesn't play it that way. Actually, there's an equally good way of reading it, as Troy is the city of civilization. Troy is this extraordinarily rich cultured space that is being attacked by savage Greeks. So it's very morally equivocal.
And what do you think of the rereadings we were looking at, Tom? I mean, if we could start with The Song of Achilles, which is Madeline Miller's debut novel. I mean, she's a classics teacher. She has written a novel which looks at the childhoods of the Homeric heroes Achilles and Patroclus and gives these two heroes a backstory before the action of the Iliad starts, and then actually continues it through. And she clearly loves that poem very much, doesn't she, Tom? And it's a very sort of loving recreation of this backstory. What did you make of it?
I think that one of the aspects, particularly about the Iliad, is that it is always giving hints of action off stage. it's providing just little hints of this vast cosmos of events and dynamics and people that Homer isn't actually dwelling upon. And one of those, obviously, is the childhoods of the heroes who figure in the Iliad. And Achilles stands absolutely at the centre of the poem. And his beloved Patroclus is a much more minor figure, but again, terribly significant. And so, grounded as we are in concepts of modern psychology, grounded as readers of the novel, we want to give what Homer doesn't give, which is a backstory and a sort of interiority. I'm sure that that must be what encourages writers to go back and, you know, provide what Homer hasn't, but which Homer is sort of encouraging.
What did you make of it, Tim? Did you enjoy it?
Well, I did. I'm a real sucker for these rich topographical descriptions. I love Greece as a place I love to visit. And it's very rich in evocative language of fetlocks and jaunces and corncrakes and all that sort of thing. So I loved all that side of it. There's a narrative problem that she faces in that Patroclus dies before Achilles. So I was always wondering, as I read through it, how she was actually going to finish the Iliad off when the narrator is dead.
Absolutely.
And she has I don't know whether we're allowed to spoil the plot, but she has a way of doing that. In terms of the balance of the narrative, if you like, the first third of it, I actually thought was a little bit slow. Maybe it's because I went to a boarding school myself. It just it felt like a very familiar sort of story of boarding school fumbles. And I think I was waiting for the Iliad to get going, and I felt that the Iliad was very accelerated through.
So I want to move on now to look at a completely different treatment, which is Alice Oswald's poem Memorial, which strips back the Iliad radically and creates her own poetic vision around it. Tim, what did you think of it?
Well, I thought this was brilliant. I mean, again, it was a way into the Iliad without the major characters. And in fact, this is quite the opposite. This is like a literary Wootton Bassett. It's a parade of the dead, the people that get trashed by the major characters. It's got a sort of liturgical, repetitive quality to it. It's called Memorial, and she plays constantly with the theme that it's rather like a war memorial. The typeface goes into these small capitals. I just thought it was a very rich, poetic treatment, very inventive, and I loved the idea of this reclaiming of the these minor figures who litter the pages of the Iliad and making them central.
Right, because she strips back the Iliad to the deaths in it, and there is death upon death upon death. She has removed the surrounding material, and we're left with this cavalcade of dying men, which has this extraordinary force, don't you think, Tom?
It does, and of course, the last person to die in the Iliad is Hector. And you get to that, you get, and Hector died like everyone else. He's given no more weight, no more or less. And the effect is absolutely to personalise these names in this fantastically ancient epic, and to give, as you read it, this emotional jolt. So someone dies, and we are given the death howl of the father finding him gone. And it's that sense of the person, the cost of war, which of course is such a cliche, but because this is the Iliad, it's the primal text of war, where it all begins, it really, really intensifies the power of what is being said and done.
I think that sense of the jolt is really important as well. She's obviously discomforting us. And I found that this was most striking, actually, in one particular very banal word, but the word like. Normally, in similes, we'd use the word as. But she says, rather than just like something, she says like something does something else. It's a real jolt to us,
exactly,
as readers.
It's grammatically wrong.
It feels like a bad first-year undergraduate translation. So jolts me in particular.
Talking of translations, I'd like us to talk about now, there are a couple of new translations of the Iliad. I mean, part of me feels there are so many translations of the Iliad. Why does the world need another one? But it feels like every generation needs a fresh one. Stephen Mitchell's new translation of the Iliad, Tim, is sold as a sort of contemporary retelling of this ancient epic. It's supposed to be fast, it's readable, it gets the modern reader through it. How successful did you think it was?
I think that what he wants to write is a lean, slick, unencumbered translation that reads in a way that's accessible and has immediate impact for us now. And I think he does do that, but he does it at a cost. One way in which it is less successful is that there is a sense of bathos. Every now and again you'll get a splendid simile that's suddenly cut down to earth by something like they had dinner, or some phrase that just sounds so banal compared to the rest of what's going on.
I mean, I think also that there are certain works of literature in which a sense of the antique is an important part of their effect. I mean, Herodotus, the first great prose writer, also there are, you know, it is in a sense consciously archaic, and there are those elements in Homer. He's using epithets that have been worn smooth over the retelling, and there are embedded within there fragments of what are clearly very, very ancient poetry. And I think that to render it as though it is absolutely up-to-date 21st century is giving the wrong impression of how it would have been experienced by the Greeks.
It feels like everything that can be done to Homer has been done to Homer, but I wonder, Tom, whether you feel there's anything left that you would like to see as a treatment of Homer.
I think that Homer will always provide opportunities to be recreated in a creative way, and I think that the Alice Oswald book demonstrates that. And I had my eyes particularly opened by a science fiction book I read a year or so back by a guy called Dan Simmons, who resets the Iliad on Mars, in the shadow of Mount Olympus on Mars in AD 3000. And the gods are nano-enhanced uber-humans playing with normal humans as gods play with the heroes on the plain of Troy. And that, for me, I've never thought of using Homer in that way. So you never know what people are going to come up with.
I agree. Bring it on. Any medium is good for reinventing this poetry. It was originally oral poetry. It was designed for performance in large-scale settings. So, you know, musicals, rap, whatever, bring it on.
Tom Holland and Tim Whitmarsh there talking to Charlotte Higgins. If you want details of any of the books discussed, you can find them on the podcast page at guardian.co.uk/books. Now, at the start of this programme, we heard Sam Leith reading an extract from his book, You Talking to Me. In it, he examines how people have taught, practised and thought about rhetoric from the ancient Greeks to the present day, taking in everyone from Cicero and Erasmus to Hitler, Obama and Homer Simpson. So Sam, we've been talking all about the Iliad, and the Iliad comes from Homer. Now, I note that you don't have any references to Homer in your book, You Talking to Me. Why is this?
Well, I do actually have a reference to Homer Simpson. It's a bit lower brow. But really, I mean, what my book treats with is rhetoric as a kind of field of knowledge and as a field of study. And that starts much after Homer was writing. I mean, of course, people were making speeches and talking each other around. I mean, that's been happening since first caveman and the first cavewoman agreed to cohabit under the first mammoth skin. But as something that you can study, that you can take what we do naturally and understand how it works and improve it by art, that dates back really to 5th century BC.
And you make a very interesting point that it grew out of chaos. And I wonder how much that is pertinent today, because your study goes from Aristotle to Obama. Do you think that the interest in it is flowering now because we're in a state of chaos again?
Well, I think certainly what rhetoric, you know, has done, in fact, what, you know, people say, you know, what's rhetoric done for us? And it's really responsible for all of Western civilization. I mean, you know, the law and representative parliaments are no more than kind of rhetoric and the arts of persuasion being enshrined in the kind of civic process. So certainly, you know, as you see the Arab Spring, you know, spreading as sort of democracy spreads around the world, rhetoric goes with it.
Do you think there's an extent to which we don't think we are rhetorical now?
Yes, I think there is. I mean, I think, you know, when you hear someone use the word rhetoric, they normally use it as a boo word.
And empty rhetoric.
Empty rhetoric, or just rhetoric, or, you know, he's a rhetorician, you know, he's not sincere. And, if, you know, a suspicion of rhetoric like that goes back to Plato.
And then, of course, the Republicans used it against Obama, didn't they?
Yes, they said, you know, he's just a person of words. But, you know, the Republicans didn't start campaigning in dance or semaphore or, you know, posting plasticine models of themselves through the doors of voters. They campaigned with rhetoric. So when you hear someone talk about rhetoric as empty rhetoric, maybe rhetoric, that is itself a rhetorical strategy. You know, what seems to us rhetorical is basically rhetoric that isn't working.
So let's just go to the structure of your book. You've structured it along the lines of the canons of rhetoric, the five canons of rhetoric. What are they?
They are essentially a kind of guide to making a speech from beginning to end. and they are invention, where you think up your arguments. You know, that's where it sort of starts out in the brain, as it were. And then arrangement, where you put them in order. Style, where, of course, all these wonderful figures of speech, the sort of Rococo vocabulary of rhetoric, which we're used to, you know, anaphora and epizeuxis and hendiasis.
Well, I'm not familiar with those. Are you familiar with them?
I am now. but that's where you know, you give polish and linguistic excitement to the speech or, you know, oration or whatever it is you're doing. And then there's memory, which, of course, much less important in the age of the auto cue. And then, of course, delivery, because there's no use in having the world's greatest speech if you mumble it into your kneecaps.
Now, what I really liked about this was that after each of these sections, you had an exemplar of it. Is an exemplar a rhetorical word?
It's just a word. I think all words are rhetorical words. It's a good
okay,
word.
I'll use
though.
It. I'm claiming it for my own.
I like
own,
exemplar. It sounds fancier than...
Anyway,
example.
Your examples, you have great orators. I imagine you think they're great. And you start with Satan.
Well, you know, the Prince of Lies is the original rhetorical speaker. And he's very... I use Milton's Satan, actually, because he's fabulous. And because, actually, Milton himself was, of course, steeped in rhetoric. So, you know, steeped in the classical study of rhetoric. So his Satan's a kind of very good instance to start with. You know, we do slightly like the devil. We're tempted by him, as is his job. And, you know, the fact that the devil is used to sell everything from whipped cream to car insurance, probably, is a sign that we tend to identify with him a bit
so
more
talking,
than the other guy.
Talking of devils, you also have Adolf Hitler as one of your examples.
He is the classic, obvious example, I think, of somebody who, you know, was very, very, you know, he's the sort of example that shores up the idea, you know, you have to be careful of good orators, because he was a very effective orator. He was a very deliberate, cunning orator. You know, he contrived his speech. You know, all the sort of ranting and raving was very calculated and very careful. And he scoped out his venues before. You know, he looked at the acoustics. He looked at how he was going to arrive, at the sort of set dressing. And he also had these, was a sort of interesting theory. He said that it was always better to speak in the evenings because people are more easily moved emotionally in the evenings. And I think this is probably a byproduct of having launched his putches in beer halls.
Yeah, the other one I always remember is, if you're going to tell a lie, tell a big lie, which...
Yes.
Is a sort of rhetorical statement,
it is, absolutely. It's got... I mean, it's all got to do with conviction. I mean, the foundation stone of rhetorical success, which Aristotle set out, is ethos. He said there are three appeals: ethos, pathos, and logos, you know. And pathos is the appeal to the emotions. Logos is the actual argument, which is a kind of poor third, I think. But ethos is all about how you present yourself as a speaker, how you connect with the audience. And absolutely kind of confidence, you know, as somebody once said, you know, if you sincerity is the thing. If you can fake that, you've got it made.
Mm-hmm. Now, which brings us to the two Americans on your list. We've got Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King and Barack Obama, actually three. Interesting that America provides half of your examples.
I think the reason I was attracted to the American instances is because America generally has much more of a sort of tolerance for the high style and for, you know, if you like, the sort of thrilling classical rhetoric than we do now. I mean, Obama could say, "Yes, we can," and people would sort of faint with joy. Whereas if David Cameron would start saying, "Yes, we can," you know, the other side of the house would instantly start saying, "Oh, no, we can't." And actually the founding fathers, you know, the framers of the US Constitution, were themselves, they were grammar school boys, and they were deeply steeped in classical rhetoric.
So does this almost bring us to your final category, which is the unknown speechwriter, which I think is rather lovely that you end up with the unknown speechwriter?
Well, I wanted to make the point that oratory is, it's a formal discipline, it's a skill, and that a lot of the people who deliver great speeches have had them honed by great, great speechmakers. And that isn't to say that they're simply mouthpieces, because a good speechwriter always effectively works to the orator's strengths. And, you know, Obama had Jon Favreau, who was a young rhetoric geek, and who was said of writing for Obama, it's like being Ted Williams' batting coach. You know, it's a really tough job because he knows how to do it better than you do. But there are also, you know, Peggy Noonan, who Jon Favreau admired immensely, was Reagan's speechwriter and wrote some wonderful speeches for Reagan. And that's, the speechwriter effectively kind of crosses the ideological divide. It's a skill, you know, you're writing to a brief. And there's such artistry in that, and such unsung artistry, I really wanted to celebrate it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting you mentioned Peggy Noonan, because what is absolutely glaring in this list is there are no women in it, and yet you at the same time make the statement, we're now living at the dawn of the great age of rhetoric by women, with Margaret Thatcher as our Cicero.
Well, yes, there was a tongue faintly in cheek there, but actually, you know, Thatcher was a very effective speaker. Actually, at the time, the reason she was so successful electorally was she was able to kind of project herself as this, you know, very capable housewife figure. She projected herself as, you know, saying balancing the budget is like balancing, you know, your domestic shopping list almost. And the way she presented herself as a sort of ordinary middle-class woman was exactly what the country seemed to want. The absence of women from my book, and God, I looked for them, I really did, is unfortunately testament to the fact that this was a subject that was taught, but it stopped being taught about the time that women started being taught in the law courts and in parliaments, which were the places where it flourished most of all in formal oratory. Women were largely absent for the period of thousands of years in which it was, you know, in common currency. And Elizabeth I, you know, there's her speech at Tilbury as her troops went off to fight the Armada. That's in there, but yeah, few and far between, I'm afraid.
We hereby set down a challenge for anybody listening to this podcast. If you can think of a great female rhetorician, please do say so on the page of this podcast on the Guardian Books website, which is guardian.co.uk. Sam, thank you very much for coming in and you talking to me, which is a quote from?
A quote from Robert De Niro in Taxi Driver.
And it's published by Profile.
Thank you.
And that's it for this week's podcast. But there's lots more stuff elsewhere over the coming week, and here is Richard Lee to fill us in.
Yes, in Saturday's Guardian Review, the editor of a new edition of P.G. Wodehouse's Letters will talk about how letters enabled this most buttoned up of English humorists to unbutton himself. Meanwhile, the Observer's new review on Sunday reveals the winner of this year's Graphic Short Story Award, run in conjunction with Jonathan Cape. There's also an electronic book of all the past winners from the last 5 years of the award. Some marvellous things there. You'll be able to find that on the website. Also over the weekend, look out for our Guardian Book Club podcast with David Nichols. He's also written about his experience of writing One Day.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks also to Tim Whitmarsh, Tom Holland, Charlotte Higgins, Sam Leith, not to mention Homer Aristotle and the Simpsons scriptwriters. If you want to make sure you get occasional treats like our David Nichols Book Club interview, as well as this weekly books podcast, why not sign up to become a regular subscriber? You can do so either on iTunes or at guardian.co.uk/books. Just click on the podcast button at the top of the page. It's as simple as that. Meanwhile, from me, Claire Armistead, and our producer, Simon Barnard, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.